I'm Tracy from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Are you a small business owner or even someone who dreams of entrepreneurship? Then check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from iHeart Podcasts and Intuit QuickBooks. Join hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres as they interview entrepreneurs sharing insights around starting and nurturing a small business. You won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too.
When you think about the future, what kind of technology do you envision? Whatever the future holds, artificial intelligence will undoubtedly be at the heart of it all. Join Graham Class as he hosts season 2 of Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast, and hear from the minds transforming healthcare, retail, entertainment, personal computing, and more with the help of AI. Tune in every other Tuesday and explore the latest technology that's changing our world today and creating a more accessible tomorrow. Listen to Technically Speaking, an Intel podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Stuff You Missed in History Class from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hello and welcome to the podcast. I'm Holly Fry.
And I'm Tracy B. Wilson.
And today we're going to talk about a topic that we've actually had quite a few requests for. Most recently, I had a request from a listener who came to see one of the live shows in Salt Lake. And I feel bad because I did not get her name, but she is a postal worker. And I had mentioned women U.S. postal workers being on my short list of topics that I wanted to do during Q&A after that show. And she came up and introduced herself, and she took a photo with me, and she was super charming and sweet. So it made me want to cover this topic even more. So we're finally going to get to it. Women postal workers in the United States Postal Service.
The earliest reference to a female postal worker is in a periodical called The Postal Record from June 1896. So we should clarify, postal worker in the United States. There's an article in that issue about a woman named Lydia Hill, who was the first person in charge of the mail for Salem, Massachusetts in the late 17th century. So women have been part of the postal services from the colonies all the way back to that time, when those services in what became the United States were basically in their infancy.
In part, the early involvement of women in getting the mail delivered really stemmed from a simple matter of logistics. Most mail at this point went through establishments like local general stores, which were often family-owned and run. So it wouldn't be unusual for the ladies of the family to be part of the process. But even outside of handling actual parcels and letters, women were the ones taking care of post riders on their stops. And if a patriarch of a family business that also handled mail were to die and leave his wife a widow, she would often simply assume her late husband's duties to keep the family business going, and that included handling mail.
One such woman was Elizabeth Timothy. She's often touted as the first woman newspaper publisher and editor in the United States. And she stepped into that role when her husband, Lewis, passed away. Lewis Timothy had been encouraged in his publishing career by a young Benjamin Franklin, and his leadership role at the South Carolina Gazette was part of a 6-year partnership with Franklin. But when Lewis died, there was a year remaining on that contract, and the couple's eldest son, Peter, was only 13, definitely not ready to take on the job, although he had been Lewis's apprentice.
And so Elizabeth stepped into her late husband's position in January of 1739. Franklin was amenable to this arrangement with the understanding that Elizabeth was filling in until Peter could realistically take over the job himself. And along with the editing and publishing, of course, came the work of handling letters and parcels. Peter did eventually take over the family printing business, but not until 1746 when he was 21.
As the Revolutionary War took hold of the colonies and many men were serving in the military, their jobs, including mail handling, were often assumed by women in the interim. We hear a lot about similar things happening in all of the other wars, basically. In particular, World War II and World War I. So we hear a lot about this happening in World War II and sometimes World War I, but we don't really hear about it as much during the American Revolutionary War, even though this happened basically in all of the wars where a lot of American men went to fight. And other men in other nations, too.
Yeah, that's not an uncommon thing. You know, when men go to war, the women step up and take over a lot of the jobs that need to be done. Other notable early U.S. postal women included Mary Catherine Goddard, who was appointed postmaster of Baltimore, Maryland in 1775. Like Elizabeth Timothy, Goddard also had some other business credentials. She grew up the daughter of the New London, Connecticut postmaster, who was also a physician. And Mary's brother William actually established the colonial postal system, but as he became busy with other tasks, the day-to-day of the postal work was largely handled by Mary and their mother, Sarah Updike Goddard.
Mary was so proficient in her work that giving her the official role of postmaster was a widely supported decision, and she was a really devoted worker. She took her duties and responsibilities so seriously that she would at times pay postal riders out of her own pocket when it was necessary. Basically, anything to keep the service running smoothly and ensuring that the people that she served continued to receive all of their correspondence.
And eventually, though, Mary Catherine Goddard was ordered to resign from her post by Postmaster General Samuel Osgood. That order was issued in 1789 in anticipation of Baltimore becoming the regional headquarters for the Postal Service. Osgood's opinion was that the travel and workload that the post would demand as a consequence of this expanded role was simply going to be too much for a woman to handle, and he appointed one of his buddies to the job. Goddard actually fought her dismissal on the basis that her work had been impeccable, which everyone agreed with, and her post office was, quote, the most punctual and regular of any upon the continent. Unfortunately, despite a huge support from the community, her appeals never resulted in reinstatement. Her petition to Postmaster General Osgood, though, is now a part of the National Archives.
The first woman to be appointed as a postmaster under the United States Constitution was Sarah Moore Delano Decrow, and that was a position she was appointed to in 1792. Her post office was in Hertford, North Carolina, and while she held a prominent position, she really wasn't happy with her pay. In 1793, she wrote to the U.S. Postmaster General Timothy Pickering, threatening to resign over it. But his assistant's response was that she was receiving the highest compensation allowed to any of the postmaster's deputies. While she didn't get the raise that she wanted, she decided to stay in the job, and she was the postmaster until she died in early 1795.
Yeah, Sarah Decrow is actually a pretty interesting topic, and she may end up being an episode all on her own. And despite the fact that there were women doing perfectly good work in the fledgling postal service in the 1700s, by the 1800s, it had actually become forbidden for women to serve as post office clerks. And if a man were to appoint a woman to such a job, he would be fired from the postal service as well. Just the same, in plenty of establishments like the general stores and printing shops that we've been talking about since the beginning of this episode, women were still handling the mail. They just didn't have any official title attached to the work that they were doing.
By the 1830s, however, there were instances of the post office department approving cases of widows stepping into their deceased husband's mail jobs as the quickest means to basically keep everything running smoothly. But because President Andrew Jackson made Postmaster General a position in the presidential cabinet, it cemented the push out of women from the work for a while. Post office jobs were often traded for political favors, and since women weren't part of the political process, they simply weren't in the running for the work.
And that actually went on for a few decades until the U.S. found itself at war internally. But before we get into that, let's pause for just a moment for a word from one of our sponsors.
I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs, and if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out Season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, Small Business Success Stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner.
Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turns sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am like I am where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how. I don't know where. I don't know what. God, if you show me. God, if you tell me. God, if no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
History stuff.
As has been the case repeatedly in history, wartime shifts the job landscape, and the U.S. Civil War was no exception. As many of the nation's men went to battle, jobs in the Postal Service were left vacant, so women were temporarily hired into post office positions for the duration of the war.
And the women that stepped into those positions were really good at their work, so much so that when the war was over, Postmaster General Montgomery Blair praised that work, saying that the women employees were, quote, more faithful in the performance of their duties than the men.
This really opened the doors again to postal work for women. The dead letter office in particular became staffed by significantly more women than men by 1865. But even though they were there and doing fantastic work, they were being paid far less than men for the same job. Women earned, on average, across various postal positions, $400 to $700 a year, an estimated 35% less than their male counterparts.
This was not really a case, though, of apples-to-apples work comparison, either. Often the women were taking on greater responsibility than the men who were being paid more. For example, in the dead letter office, the men were often opening the letters, but the women were the ones that were trying to piece together information and do the detective work to ensure those letters got to their intended recipients.
While we may think of wage disparity as a social issue that only came to light in the mid-20th century, this pay gap was being discussed openly in the late 1860s. The New York Times addressed it in a printed letter to the editor on February 13th, 1869, titled Women as Government Clerks.
And this editorial opens with, quote, "Whatever arguments may be urged with more or less force against the theory of women's political equality with man, very few persons deny the justice of the principle that equal work should command equal pay without regard to the sex of the laborer. But it is one thing to acknowledge the right of a principle and quite another to practice it."
This article goes on to discuss the various branches of government and how women are positioned in each. But when it gets to the Postal Service, it addresses why men are given the job of opening the mail.
Quote, "The Post Office Department employs 50 women in the dead letter office in redirecting the letters, which are first opened by men who for this merely mechanical work receive salaries of the first and some even of the second grade. The letters must be opened by men because, as is said, immoral things are sometimes found. To see these things would, it is supposed, corrupt the morals of women. It is not argued, I believe, that man is stronger morally than woman, but rather that in doing this work he will be injured less than her, because he has less moral sentiment to be corrupted. Or in other words, the less strength persons have, the less they are in danger of falling."
This still is a theme that exists. That, yeah. Like, women somehow need to be protected by official policy.
Yeah.
So, this passage is followed up with a note on the position of one of the Postmaster General's assistants, who went on record as saying he believed that mature or elderly women were able to safely open any item and deal with the contents without demoralization and, quote, with perfect propriety.
That sort of cracks me up. I just... it's hilarious. In 1866, the U.S. Congress issued the official postal laws and regulations, and in them... women in postal work are acknowledged by the government for the first time on record, though it's not really in the best way. These regulations actually stipulated that minors and married women were excluded by law from holding a position as postmaster, as they could not legally execute an official bond.
These rules did change a few years later. In 1873, the regulations updated to say that married women could hold the position of postmaster and that bonds executed by them would be valid. That same year, there was a federal law enacted that gave government managers the power to appoint women as clerks at equal pay to men. But that didn't magically change things. The law wasn't enforced, and even 3 years later, women were still earning approximately 25% less than men holding the same postal jobs.
And as the suffragette movement became more vocal about this disparity in pay and opportunities for women, there was still really strong opposition. There was still a strong belief within the postal system that while women were capable of working in large cities where they had lots of supervision, they wouldn't be able to handle more rural postmaster positions because they wouldn't be able to handle leadership jobs without male superiors on hand.
So, while women were still struggling to get even footing in the job side of the postal system, women were using the postal system more and more as correspondence became more fashionable than ever. But even as customers, there was serious segregation in the works when it came to the design of post offices, with separate counters for women and men in some cities.
There were plenty of people within the post office who felt that women postmasters were disruptive to society. Women who worked for a living were seen as less likely to marry, thus preventing some lucky gent from starting a family. And there were assertions that male clerks complained less and worked harder.
In 1902, Postmaster General Henry C. Payne made it clear that he felt that women should be supported by their husbands and should stay home and take care of their households, and went so far as to issue a statement that if a woman who was already working for the post office were to marry, she would no longer be a postal worker. Some women employees of the USPS were required to submit formal letters stating their marital status and the details of their husband's work if they were married.
But there were proponents of women postal workers within the system. In 1906, Postmaster General George Cortelyou was open in his belief that women were perfectly suited for postal work, as it gave them an opening into government work while also offering the chance to stay close to and involved with their communities. And at this point in the timeline, women held about 10% of the government's postmaster positions.
Thanks to a shortage of city mail carriers in 1917, after a large number of men quit their carrying jobs due to pay and labor condition disputes, women got a new opportunity to work, not just as clerks, but as regular city route workers. Of course, there were doubters who thought that women couldn't handle the job and that merely carrying a mailbag around would be too much for them. Two women were hired for temporary positions on city routes.
Yeah, there was one piece I was reading about it that was pointing out that women had been carrying around babies that wiggle in addition to being heavy for a long time, and that maybe mailbags would not be such a problem. And then World War One once again saw a bump in the number of women employed in the postal service as many men went to war. Although this was largely temporary, many of those women had been married to the men that left, and most of the women who had filled vacant positions left those jobs to make them available once again for returning soldiers.
1921 saw a major change when Will Hayes became Postmaster General. He removed the ban on married women in the Postal Service that Harry C. Payne had instituted almost two decades earlier.
And when World War II came around, women once again became the focus of Postal Service discussion, as jobs needed to be filled, but the Postmaster General at that time, Frank Walker, still felt that women could work as clerks, but that they should not carry the mail. He had to reverse his position, though, as more and more of the men in his Postal Service left to serve in the military, and he really had no other option.
Coming up, we're going to talk about the postal uniforms and other moves toward workforce equality, as well as some notable ladies in postal service history. But first, we will pause for a word from one of our sponsors. I'm Tracy V. Wilson from Stuff You Missed in History Class. Did you know small businesses make up 99.9% of all businesses in the United States? The world is powered by entrepreneurs. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks. And every episode, hosts Austin Hankwitz and Janice Torres talk to entrepreneurs about how they've grown from the lessons of launching and nurturing a small business, and how they have found success being their own boss. From the excitement of first starting out to finding the right tools and resources to process invoices and payments like QuickBooks Money, you won't want to miss these inspiring stories of entrepreneurship and discovering ways to business differently so you can too. And if you're a small business owner or even someone dreaming of starting your own business, then you'll want to check out season 2 of Mind the Business, small business success stories from Ruby Studio, from iHeartMedia, and Intuit QuickBooks.
iHeart Podcast Update. This week on your free iHeartRadio app.
Fodor's Guide to Espionage, a 60s-era spy story of the world's first and greatest travel writer, Eugene Fodor, as he jet sets around the globe. Tongue Unbroken Season 2. This podcast explores complex concepts of identity, resilience, erasure, and genocide. Table for Two Season 2. Think of the show as a deconstructed Oscar party in podcast form. Each episode takes place over the romance of a meal and feels like you're seated next to a different guest at that dinner. Hear these podcasts and more on your free iHeartRadio app or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Neil Strauss, host of the Tenderfoot TV True Crime Podcast, To Live and Die in L.A. I'm here to tell you about the new podcast I've been undercover investigating for the last year and a half. It's called To Die For. Here's a clip.
All these girls were sent out into the world, and they were told, try to meet important men, try to attach yourself to important men.
The voice you're hearing is a Russian model agent telling me about spies sent out to seduce men with political power.
The war in Ukraine is also being fought by all these girls that are all over important cities.
For the first time, a military-trained seduction spy reveals how the Russian government turned sex and love into a deadly weapon.
If you want to kill your target, it's easy. You just seduce him, take him somewhere, start having sex, and then he's very vulnerable, so you can kill him easily.
To Die For is available now. Listen for free on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm preaching to somebody today who is waiting for God to give you your next step. And you don't know what it is yet. You need God to show you your next step. Because God, I can't stay where I am, like I am, where it is. This isn't going to work. I have to move on, but I don't know where. A lot of time you'll use it as an excuse. Well, I don't know how, I don't know where, I don't know what. God, if you show me, God, if you tell me, God, no. You know enough right now. And if you needed to know more, he would show you.
Hey, this is Stephen Furtick. I want to invite you to listen to my podcast, Elevation with Stephen Furtick. I am here to help you for the battles that you face in life, for the times when you feel discouraged, for the times that you need guidance from God. I want to give you the truth of what he says about you to help you rise to your full potential. Listen to Elevation with Stephen Furtick every Sunday and Friday on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
After World War II, the number of women working in the U.S. Postal Service increased from year to year, though there were still very few women employed as mail carriers. And they were still a small enough segment of the U.S. Postal Service that there had never been a standardized uniform for them.
Skirts were added to the official uniform in 1955, but it took another full decade before a woman's uniform standard was established. Finally, in the 1960s, there were enough women in the USPS to merit this move.
In 1962, President John F. Kennedy passed the Equal Pay Act, legally establishing the right to equal pay for women and men in federal jobs.
From 1964 to 1974, women went from making up 8% of the Postal Service's employees to more than 18%, and the largest area of growth was as mail carriers.
In the mid-1970s, Postmaster General E.T. Clazin founded the Postal Service Women's Program to identify women who would make good leaders and then offer training to enable more women to move into higher levels of employment within the Postal Service. However, it should be noted that while that program certainly helped some women, Mary Valentino, who was the woman who was really pivotal in designing that program, was unhappy with its execution, and she really felt that there were some institutional issues of discrimination within the Postal Service, and she filed a class action suit against the U.S. Postal Service for discrimination. That suit was ultimately unsuccessful.
We're going to talk next about some of the notable women in USPS history, which will also, you know, fill us in what's happened between the 1970s and today.
And while we mentioned earlier that women mail carriers were virtually non-existent for a long time, there were some exceptions. And there are so many notable women in the U.S. Postal Service history, and even before it was the U.S. Postal Service, that we can't possibly include them all. So hopefully we're not missing your favorite.
The first woman given an official mail carrying post was actually back in 1845 per an appointment by Postmaster General Cave Johnson. This woman, Sarah Black, carried mail back and forth between the Charlestown, Maryland post office and the railroad daily or as required, and she was paid $48 a year.
And we know she did that job for at least 2 years. We don't know if it went much longer than that. Polly Martin was a star route carrier. That's a contract worker who carried mail, parcels, telegrams, and even passengers between Attleboro and South Attleboro, Massachusetts for 16 years, starting in 1860. She was known to be tough and smart and only faced one attempted robbery in all her time as a star carrier. That attempt failed miserably as she beat the man who had tried to climb aboard her wagon with a horsewhip until he fell away.
In 1900, the first woman full-time rural free delivery carrier was Ethel Hill. Whereas in previous years, women were sometimes listed as substitute carriers for their spouses or other male family members, Hill was the first to list a man, her father, as her substitute. Up until that point, there had been women working in the rural routes, but they were all basically serving as substitutes.
Stagecoach Mary, who we mentioned in our Six Impossible Episodes podcast, was a former slave who ran mail in Montana between Cascade and St. Peter's Mission. And her reputation was that of a rough, tough woman who was also much beloved.
Miss Etta Nelson ran a mail route in Pittsfield, Maine via horse and buggy from 1903 to 1907. She won the distinction of most efficient mail carrier in the state in 1907, shortly before she retired from her position to get married.
Catherine Stinson was the first woman to carry mail by plane. And in 1913, she dropped mail bags from the air at the Montana State Fair as part of a demonstration. She also flew regular air mail at one point from Chicago to New York, again, the first woman to do so, and that was in 1918. And that trip actually didn't go as planned. She had to land earlier than she meant to, and it ended in something of a disastrous crash for her plane. She landed in a muddy field, and her plane flipped over. Stinson was unharmed, and she did deliver the mail that was on that thing a few days later, but she broke two American flight records in the process, even though that flight did not go as planned. She had still gone further than anyone had gone before and flown longer than anyone had gone before.
The two women we mentioned earlier who were appointed to temporary positions as the first city mail carriers were Mrs. Permelia S. Campbell and Mrs. Nellie M. McGrath. Campbell was a widow, and McGrath's husband was serving in the military. Although they weren't used for more than a couple of weeks, their work was deemed highly satisfactory.
Yeah, and that was in 1917. And then in 1920, Genevieve Baskfield was made the Zumbrota, Minnesota village carrier. Postal work was in her blood. Her father was actually the local postmaster. And when her father left office in 1924, Genevieve resigned her position.
In 1963, Mrs. Evelyn Craig Brown became the first woman to deliver mail in Washington, D.C. since World War II.
In 1985, Jackie Strange was the first woman to rise to the position of Deputy Postmaster General, the number two position in the U.S. Postal Service. She started her postal career as a temporary clerk in 1946, and she slowly made her way up the ladder over the course of the next 40 years. She retired in 1987.
Just a little more than a year ago, on March 6, 2015, the first female Postmaster General of the United States, Megan Brennan, was sworn in. Brennan has worked for the Postal Service for 30 years and started as a mail carrier, a job long believed to be too strenuous for women.
My hat is off to all of these gals. I have a female postal carrier, and I love her.
I have to confess, I am not sure who our mail carrier is. This is because we live upstairs, and I don't think I ever see the mail being delivered.
I do. Plus, she'll always, you know, if there's a parcel, she will always come and knock on the door. And if it's raining, she will always put it in a bag and make sure it's tucked up on our deck, or she'll knock on the door. If she sees the car in the driveway, she knows I'm probably teleworking, and she'll come and say hi and drop off the mail in a bag so it doesn't get wet. She's the best.
Nice.
I love her. I also have a little bit of listener mail, which is related to this, and it is one of the many requests sort of that we've gotten, but it's also a very funny story. I'm not going to read her whole mail, but I will read the part that is germane to this topic, and it is from our listener Meredith. And she said, hello, I love your podcast, and that now I must seem like a jack of all trades to people because of the random historical events that I bring up in conversations. Recently, there was a listener mail that mentioned that you should do a podcast on females becoming mail carriers. This made me think of one of my favorite stories about my daughter, Maddie. When she was 4, we got a new female mail carrier. The old one, she puts that in quotes, was also a female. One day, while we were walking, she saw a very tall black man delivering mail. And she kind of looked at him funny, and I thought, oh no, she is looking at him because of his race. And I asked her why she was making that puzzled face, and she said, I didn't know men could do that job. She is 7 now, and she still doesn't know why this story is funny. I love this so much. It's like such a great out of the mouth of babes moment that I wanted to include it in this one. If you would like to write to us, you can do so at historypodcast@howstuffworks.com. We're also at facebook.com/mistinhistory, on Twitter @mistinhistory, at pinterest.com/mistinhistory, at mistinhistory.tumblr.com, and on Instagram @mistinhistory. If you would like to learn more about what we talked about today, you can go to our parent site, How Stuff Works. Type in USPS in the search bar and you will get an article called How the USPS Works, so you can learn all about how the post office works. If you'd like to visit us, you should do that at mistinhistory.com, and there you will find show notes for all of the episodes Tracy and I have worked on, as well as every episode of Missed in History that has ever existed from the very beginning, long before we were hosts. So we encourage you, come and visit us at howstuffworks.com and mistinhistory.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit HowStuffWorks.com.
It's been almost 3,000 years, and Greek mythology has proved that it is not going anywhere. But it can be difficult to find entertaining and engaging retellings of these myths that aren't fictionalized. Lucky for you, I'm here. Let's Talk About Myths, Baby is the Greek mythology and ancient history podcast of your dreams. I dive into the convoluted and confusing ancient sources so you don't have to. Listen to Let's Talk About Myths, Baby on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
I'm Saleha Mohsen, and I've covered economic policy for years and reported on how it impacts people across the United States. In 2016, I saw how voters were leaning towards Trump and how so many Americans felt misunderstood by Washington. So I started The Big Take DC. We dig into how money, politics, and power shape government and the consequences for voters. With new episodes every Thursday, you can listen to The Big Take DC on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
The Therapy for Black Girls podcast is your space to explore mental health, personal development, and all of the small decisions we can make to become the best possible versions of ourselves. I'm your host, Dr. Joy Harden Bradford, a licensed psychologist in Atlanta, Georgia, and I can't wait for you to join the conversation every Wednesday. Listen to the Therapy for Black Girls podcast on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. Take good care, and we'll see you there.
Hey, I'm Jay Shetty, and I'm the host of the On Purpose podcast, and I had the opportunity to talk to one of Hollywood's major icons, Michael B. Jordan. In our conversation, Michael shares the highs, the lows, and everything in between, offering a genuine glimpse into his world.
The closest to getting what you want is always the hardest. People give up right before they get what they've always wanted to get.
Listen to On Purpose with Jay Shetty on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.